broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And welcome to The Dividing Line on this Tuesday afternoon. My name is James White, and we are going to be talking about a number of things today. We have a lot of things to talk about, numerous various and sundry issues. I'm still not hearing my computer. I'm asking for it to be turned up, but it is not there. We're trying to bring it up.
Read my book.
Ah, there it is. Yes, read my book.
Read my book.
Read my book. I heard that over and over again during the course, the Bible Answer Man debate.
Read my book.
Yes, and it was in the context of the fact that I had challenged the folks that were debating me, and it was more than one, to answer some particular biblical passages. For example,
I have yet to hear an answer to Genesis 50, Acts 4, Isaiah 10, and hence I would say I continue to hold the biblical ground at that
point. Read my book.
Read my book, Genesis 50, Isaiah 10, and Acts 4. Well, as you know, if you've been looking at the blog, you know that I have now gotten hold of the book, and so we're going to be commenting on what did George Bryson say about Genesis 50, Isaiah 10, and Acts chapter 4. We're going to find out. But first things first, we have many things to talk about today. First and foremost, I wanted to note that we have some folks that are very much involved with the ministry. And specifically, Mike Porter's wife, Shannon, is expecting a baby. In fact, the baby was due a few days ago. My wife was instructing Mr. Porter, who we call the Gobbler, to make sure to have the baby today, because today would allow, today's the 3rd of February in 2004. So it would be 2-3-4. And so evidently, that may end up happening, I'm not sure, because we got word today that Shannon fell, and she has broken her arm very badly, and in fact, they're going to have surgery on her arm, and of course, since she's already past due, they don't want to do surgery in that situation, so they may be inducing labor, and so right after the program's over, I'm going to be heading down to the hospital, and so if you'd pray for Mike and Shannon Porter, this is their first child. This is not the way a new mom wants to start off with a broken arm and her first baby all at the same time. But, of course, 20 years down the road, it will be the stuff of constant discussion and hopefully happy memories. But right now, of course, we need to pray for her because she must be in a lot of pain. And so I cannot imagine what it would be like to have a baby and have your arm broken at the same time. That's just seems like way too much. So pray for Mike and Shannon Porter, and I'll be heading down that direction as soon as the program is over. So first things first. Secondly, lots of stuff going on. If you saw the blog, we have some material there about Dave Hunt. Dave has Dave has been, I think, falling off into something like open theism or something. I don't know. If you look at the blog today, he's made yet another basic biblical error. Comes from not being able to deal with biblical passages in their original languages, and so he ended up making statements like he makes in his current current newsletter, and that's on the blog if you want to take a look at it, the main page at aomen.org. Of course, in the process, he's taking taking shots at other folks, and that just sort of happens. We'll obviously have much more to say about Mr. Hunt and the issue of the book coming out in just a matter of weeks. The book Debating Calvinism, my debate between myself and Mr. Hunt. Even though Amazon.com seems to think only Mr. Hunt wrote it, I'm not sure he'll write a debate book by yourself, but hey, that's sort of how it works. Passion movie. Mel Gibson and the Passion movie. I tracked down a segment of the EWTN interview that I did not have. This was not included on the DVD, and this is getting more important as we look at the sources of the film. The film's coming up in just a matter of weeks now. Oh, by the way, John Piper's book is out. I've ordered mine, haven't gotten it yet. The first five chapters are available in PDF format at, I believe it's the Passion Book. I put the URL on my blog a while back, passion-book.com or thepassion-book.com, something along those lines. But you can take a look at it there. I was very excited that within one or two pages of the beginning, Acts chapter 4, verses 27 to 28 were being cited. That may mean that George Bryson and his friends don't want to distribute that book, but, you know, it's there. And one of the key sources for the film is a book by a Roman Catholic visionary who's on her way to sainthood. Gibson carries a relic from her in his pocket. And she wrote a book called The Dolorous Passion of Christ, that allegedly gives the visions that she was given, which explains what Mary's role in the crucifixion was. And people have noted in watching the film that there's all this stuff about Mary, what Mary was doing. Well, where'd that come from? Well, it came from this book. And in the EWTN discussion of this subject, which didn't get on the DVD, he talks about this. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Where did it originate? What was the moment when you said, I want to do this story? 10 years ago, right?
Roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more like 12 or 13 years ago, I think it was.
Was there an incident, one moment?
I became acquainted with certain books and things. I started reading them, and I actually managed to, like, purchase a library for $1 a book. Nobody else wanted these things, right? So I'm like, wow, I got this huge library, and I found a place to put them and stuff, and I was reaching up for a book one day, and I pulled it out, and the cover caught on the book next to it, and the book next to it fell out, and that was the Emmerich book, right?
The Dolorous Passion.
And I started looking at that, going, oh, that's interesting. Wow, hey, wow, well, this is answering a lot of questions I've been asking. And it was at that point I was like, thinking, you know what? That's my life about, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's like starting to look into things that I had a knowledge of, but really hadn't explored as fully as I should have, so I began to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
Read all the Gospels, read the New Testament, read the Old Testament, read the, you know, and just started to go through all that and explore that.
Well, there's Mel Gibson himself giving you the role that that particular book had in his writing of the film and his beginning of the film, so on and so forth. I think that's important to keep in mind as we consider something else that that came up.
Read my book.
Oh, George, just hold on a second. We'll get to you in a second. It's you know, I
read my book.
I've got it now. It arrived. We have it. It's okay. We'll get to it a little bit later on. But I got a email. And it contained an article by John Armstrong on the Passion movie. And I was very troubled by, again, remembering John Armstrong has edited books on Roman Catholicism, one of the best books that Moody put out, had a number of different articles in it. I was very troubled by a number of the comments that were made and sources that were cited in this article from John Armstrong, who, of course, has begun promoting new perspectivism and, as a result, attacks what he calls foundationalism and talks about openness to traditions and all the rest of stuff. And one of the paragraphs reads, as I noted above, I have read numerous critiques of the Passion of the Christ. These range from the protest the film is anti-Semitic to praises of theologians and priests, the Roman Catholic Church. And there's a parenthesis that says, no, the Pope has not formally endorsed the film, and yes, Mel Gibson is a devout Christian and a faithful Roman Catholic. Now, the John Armstrong I once knew would not have allowed a statement like that to be made without qualifying and explaining it. We're talking here about someone who clearly believes in the Mass as a propitiatory sacrifice, purgatory, confession, penances, the entirety of the Roman Catholic system. He's more Catholic than the Pope is, as a sede vacantist. So obviously, to just simply make the statement as a devout Christian and a faithful Roman Catholic would be to really embrace a tremendous amount of movement from where he once was. And some of the other citations in here from Roman Catholic priests and things concerning the reflections upon the death of Christ, which is connected to the rosary and various sundry sacramental and liturgical things like that. Very, very troubling to see coming from the pen of John Armstrong, but it is somewhat indicative of this movement and what it involves and what it ends up breeding in those who buy into it. Because certainly one of the points that N.T. Wright himself makes is that if you properly understand the doctrine of justification, that it should be a great ecumenical doctrine, that it's meant to bring unity to the church, and hence should never be something over which people divide. And so new perspectivism leads into ecumenism. It breeds an attitude of ecumenism, and it can partly do so because of the fact that it takes away so much of the specificity of the doctrine of justification itself, the imputation, the righteousness of Christ, so on and so forth. It, in essence, says the divisions between Rome and Protestants were really based upon a medieval misreading of the entire subject to begin with. Rome was wrong in what she had said. My headphones are going in and out. Rome was wrong about what she had said, and the reformers, therefore, since they're responding to what Rome was saying, were likewise wrong in what they were saying. And since we've all been wrong all along, then all we have to do is embrace this perspective, and we can hold hands and sort of sing kumbaya and things like that. Hopefully all the rest of you are able to hear me all right, because my headphones are going in and out. It's very, very, very strange and odd, and hopefully not indicative of my microphone about to die as it has in the past or things like that. Anyways, I will try to press on despite that particular thing. We have a number of cuts that I'd like to play today, because as I mentioned, I got hold of The Dark Side of Calvinism. I am holding it in my hand. It, as I mentioned on the blog, is a 8.5 by 11 velo-bound type of a production here, with a black cover. Right, like I said, I saw this from afar, and at the top it says, a biblically based examination, evaluation, refutation of the Reformed doctrine of redemption and reprobation. Then underneath, The Dark Side of Calvinism, the Calvinist caste system. on the back, you have stuff from Chuck Smith. Doug Wilson is cited, which isn't that ironic, but what he actually is cited from is from a email that was posted on the web concerning a previous book. I think it is really questionable, shall we say, to put something that he said about George Bryson on the web that was in reference to his previous book, The 5 Points of Calvinism, Wade and Found Wanting. If you have to put that on the back of your new book, that's you know, I'd be like my going back and grabbing old endorsements off the King James Only controversy. I could have pulled the one from Geisler off and put it on the Potter's Freedom. Why not? Hey, whew. Anyway, there's some pretty wild stuff in here, as I mentioned. But obviously the big question everybody has had all along is, when George Bryson kept telling you over and over again that this particular book that you weren't able to see when you were in the studio answers these questions, does it answer these questions? And here's a couple of the places that was said.
That's not what Jesus says. Could you
show that? You're going to have to read the book.
That was on John. That was in, I think, the second or third hour, where we were talking about John chapter 6, And so I'm asking him where Jesus said what he was saying, and we have...
That's not what Jesus says. Could you show
me? You're going to have to read the book.
I'm going to have to read the book. Well, at least on that one, there was some discussion, a massive discussion, actually, of John chapter 6. It is tremendously confused, demonstrates that exegesis is not what this system really can engage in, and very, very confusing, disconnected from the text, jumping all over the text. You simply can't walk through John 6. You can't start at verse 35 and follow Jesus along to verse 45 and come to the end of conclusions. You've got to eisegetically read stuff into it. And so, anyway... at least on this one, where he said you have to read the book for where Jesus said this, at least I know what he's talking about now, and he's wrong, completely wrong, but it doesn't really matter. At least it was there someplace. The section that I've played before, this part, this was the key issue.
I have yet to hear an answer to Genesis 50, Acts 4, Isaiah 10, and hence I would say I continue to hold the biblical ground at this point.
Read my book.
Is there anything about Genesis chapter 50 anywhere in the dark side of Calvinism? Well, of course, there is no scriptural index. There is no subject index. There is no index at all. There's 16 zillion endnotes, but there is no subject or scripture index. And so what do you have to do? You have to look at every single page and look at every single reference. Now, some of you know that I got pretty used to doing that, and some other folks helped me out in doing that in regards to Norm Geisler's book. When we first started responding to Chosen But Free, the scripture index in the back was extremely useless. It was not the kind of scripture index that actually lists everything. And so I or others would have to go through the entirety of the book looking for specific references. And so I would buy an Amazon gift certificate, and I would send it off to primarily either Mark Ennis, who's in channel right now, or Captain Wade, who hasn't been in channel a long time, Keith up in Chicago, and they would take the book, and they would just start going up and down and up and down and up and down through the pages looking for every reference in the book. In fact, my copy of the first edition of Chosen But Free still has written in the front the index of particular passages that we needed to look at everything that he said, written in the front. And that's basically what we had to do with the dark side of Calvinism. And so I sat down with it. Now, I had mentioned to you in previous programs, Wally Balt, our brilliant Australian astronomer, Hawaiian Australian astronomer, whatever, had already gone through himself, and he did not find any references. He looked specifically for Genesis 50 and Acts 4. I was looking for all three from the clip that I've played for you before, including Isaiah chapter 10. And so I started the process. And, of course, in the process, I can't help but being reading, since I'm looking at passages as they're going by. And I found a bunch of stuff, some of the things we'll talk about, some of the things I've listed on the blog already. And so we go through, and we go through the entirety of the text. Is there any reference to Genesis 50? No. Wally Balt was right. Never is Genesis 50 cited or discussed in the entirety of the book. Acts chapter 4? Nope. No references to Acts chapter 4. How about Isaiah chapter 10? Any references to Isaiah chapter 10? No. Nowhere in the book is there any even recognition of the existence of Isaiah chapter 10 and its witness to compatibilism at all. And so, what was he meaning?
Read my book.
I did, and it's not there. George, there is no discussion of compatibilism and the passages in your book.
Read my book.
Well, it didn't answer the question. It just didn't answer the question. So we need to put "don't read my book" somewhere in there, yes, to explain that particular, I just don't, it disappeared.
That's not what Jesus says. Could you show
me? You're going to have to read the book.
Okay, well, and over and over again we were told that. And, of course, during that particular discussion, there were a number of things that we asked of Mr. Bryson. And as I was looking for those phrases, read my book, I came across a number of others that I just wanted to play for us today. I wanted to repeat. I just need to see. Do you hear there's the book in the background. Maybe I should have recorded that and made the sound effect itself. I'm reading the book. There it is. None of them were. One of the best parts of the debate. I listened to the second and third hour when I got home because I was listening to them live on the air. But I sort of forgotten about it. And as I was listening to stuff, there's some stuff that I just went, man, that really did happen. Yep, mm-hmm. Can't believe that really happened. One was when I would ask Mr. Bryson, how does God know the future? How does God? I want to remind us once again of how this answer was given.
I believe God knows everything because he's omniscient. This is his very nature to know everything. He knows everything, actually knows everything potential. So the question about does God know the future is answered. If God is omniscient, he knows everything, everything that is and could be.
I'm sorry, but doesn't it strike anyone else as strangely as it strikes me that the answer to the question, how does God know the future, is he knows the future. He's omniscient. He knows the future. That doesn't answer the question. That is a circular response. I know God is omniscient. The question is, how is God omniscient? Well, it's just by nature. That was an answer to, when I asked that question, that was an answer to he said, it was almost like, I want to answer that. I want to answer that. And I tell you, that was very interesting to me, and I found it somewhat humorous. I'm closing some of these files here, so I don't get confused as to which ones I have read. Let's see. Now this one, I'll just play it.
Genesis chapter 50, Isaiah chapter 10, and Acts chapter 4 are passages I'm going to ask George to explain to me during the course of our discussion today.
See, I announced right up front, that's from the first hour, the very first hour, I said, look, I am going, here's the passages. It's not like there was not time to do some preparation. From the very start, I announced.
Genesis chapter 50, Isaiah chapter 10, and Acts chapter 4 are passages I'm going to ask George to explain to me during the course of our discussion today.
And I never did get that explanation, did I? All I got was, read the book.
Read my book.
Yeah, read my book. Not just the book, but...
Read my book.
My book. Yes, that's what we got. We didn't get anything else. But what we would hear over and over and over again, this was the funny part, what we would hear over and over and over again is, I would ask a direct question. And the response would not be relevant. Instead, what we would get would be...
That's the problem with Calvinism.
That's how every response that I would say, so George, how about this idea of substitutionary atonement? And the response would start...
That's the problem with Calvinism.
And you'd just go on from there, and, you know, you just...
That's the problem with Calvinism.
It's always just a problem with Calvinism, and really, if you just...
Read my book.
You'd understand what the problem with Calvinism is. It's just... Just listen to... I got rolling at one point, okay? Sometimes it happens. You've all... Those of you who know me, you know that sometimes I just get rolling. And this happened at one point. And this really sort of explains it.
Teach, that's not what we believe. We believe that we evangelize because God commands us to do so, and he uses means. You've said many times, if God ordains the ends, he ordains the means to the ends. The means to the ends is that we proclaim the gospel. And I'm not saying that I experience my union with Christ and my justification from eternity. What I am saying, however, is that if substitutionary atonement is true, then the term propitiation means a removal of wrath. You decide 1 John 2:2, which refers to propitiation. If it does not remove wrath, then it's not propitiation. If that man goes to hell and Christ has propitiated God's wrath in his place, then God is unjust. It's not an attack on the cross. And 1 Timothy 2, 4 through 5, which was cited earlier about God not wanting any to perish, and 2 Peter 3, 9, if you look at both of those in their context, you'll see that in the very next verse, Paul says that Jesus Christ intercedes. He is the one mediator between God and men. And so I ask the question. The high priest always had to mediate for those who he offered the sacrifice for. If Christ's death was intended to save every individual, then Christ intercedes and mediates for every individual. So are we saying that Christ is in heaven right now interceding before the Father in behalf of every person who's already died under the wrath of God and who will be in hell forever?
The big mistake that Calvinists make, and they should know better on this, Hank, is the whole issue of they've turned solo fide into nolo fide.
Under the wrath of God and who will be in hell forever.
The big mistake that Calvinists make, and they should know better on this, Hank, is the whole issue of they've turned solo fide into nolo fide.
Has nothing to do with what I just got done saying. It's just, let's just right off. And would he ever be called on the carpet for that? No. We're not. No, he can say whatever he really wants to say at that particular point in time. Well, now you know, we had a discussion a couple weeks ago. A number of people had contacted me, and I had been listening today, that Hank was talking to a guy. Remember the guy whose brother goes to Norm Geisler's school? And this guy wanted Hank to say that we're not in the pale of Orthodox, you know, that pale where we all slosh about and throw water at each other. And Hank had made the following statement.
Now, I wasn't in this debate in any sense. I tried to moderate this debate.
So Hank was not in the debate. Well, I had a problem with that, and as I was listening to the whole thing, looking for these clips for the program today, over and over again, I kept hearing just how involved Hank was, and so I put just a few representative samples of Hank's non-involvement together. Because I'd be sitting there, and I was trying to do two or three things at once. I'm trying to listen, keep one ear on it, and I kept stopping going, I had forgotten that. Just listen.
Despite the accusations of dancing and various sundry other things, that I don't think that's fair analogy at all. When we say they had no opportunity, Hank, I want to emphasize that we are talking about individuals who not only do not desire any such opportunity,
but they're created in such a way that they cannot desire.
But again,
is that right?
They are created in the image of God, and it's their sin and their fallen nature.
Okay, but what I'm trying to establish here,
love their sin,
just so we understand.
Because if I thought it was up to me to try to convince people who are involved in some of these tremendously controlling groups that by their libertarian free will, they were somehow going to choose Christ over against the control structure that's around them, and that God would never violate their free will, then I wouldn't even bother going up to Salt Lake City and doing the things
that I'm
doing.
Is that what you would say, or do you say that it is God who changes the heart?
God changes the heart.
Now, is that what you say, or actually are you saying this? I mean, over and over again, there was this feeding of George, the answer to the question in the form of the question. It was so clear. Everybody heard it. I mean, I've seen so many, we've gotten so many emails and so many people. I just don't understand why there would be any question about the subject, you know? I don't know. It's just left utterly... utterly and completely befuddled at that, and you can just hear the going back and forth. People said in the chat channel it was right. People forgot George is even a part of this debate at times. So it was something else. Well, 877-753-3341 is the phone number. 877-753-3341.
Read my book.
Yeah, I know.
Read my book.
I tried, but it's not there. There is no discussion whatsoever of compatibilism. Recognition of these passages, just simply a mocking of the idea of God's decree. And isn't it interesting? It's exactly what ends up coming out in Dave Hunt's newsletter that was sent out today. What has happened in the world when you have Dave Hunt attacking Rick Warren in The Purpose-Driven Life for quoting from the Living Bible in Psalm 139, where Psalm 139, verse 16, talks about the fact that God has ordained our days. See, Dave Hunt is a King James only. He's not King James only, but he's King James preferred, and he doesn't seem to realize that the King James blew it in Psalm 139, and therefore you have an actuality. The Living Bible is more literal than the King James is at that point, and the Bible does say that God has ordained our days, and Dave Hunt disagrees with that. I guess Dave Hunt thinks God doesn't know when he's going to die, or doesn't ordain the day that he's going to die. Boy, all sorts of problems there. Well, it is ironic, but it is 5:30, which I think, even though I've not been given the indication, means that we're supposed to be taking a break about now. And so hopefully we'll be able to do that and take your phone calls at 877-753-3341. Let's hear what you have to say right after this.
A godly man, such a rarity today.
Read my book.
So many stars, strong and true, quickly fall away.
Under the guise of tolerance, modern culture grants alternative lifestyle status to homosexuality. Even more disturbing, some within the church attempt to revise and distort Christian teaching on this behavior. In their book, The Same-Sex Controversy, James White and Jeff Neal write for all who want to better understand the Bible's teaching on the subject, explaining and defending the foundational Bible passages that deal with homosexuality, including Genesis, Leviticus, and Romans. Expanding on these scriptures, they refute the revisionist arguments, including the claim that Christians today need not adhere to the law. In a straightforward and loving manner, they appeal to those caught up in a homosexual lifestyle to repent and to return to God's plan for His people. The Same-Sex Controversy, Defending and Clarifying the Bible's Message About Homosexuality. Get your copy in the bookstore at aomin.org.
Millions of petitioners from around the world are imploring Pope John Paul II to recognize the Virgin Mary as co-redeemer with Christ, elevating the topic of Roman Catholic views of Mary to national headlines and widespread discussion. In his book, Mary, Another Redeemer, James White sidesteps hostile rhetoric and cites directly from Roman Catholic sources to explore this volatile topic. He traces how Mary of the Bible, esteemed mother of the Lord, obedient servant, and chosen vessel of God, has become the immaculately conceived, bodily assumed Queen of Heaven, viewed as co-mediator with Christ and now recognized as co-redeemer by many in the Roman Catholic Church. Mary, Another Redeemer, is fresh insight into the woman the Bible calls blessed among women and an invitation to single-minded devotion to God's truth. You can order your copy of James White's book, Mary, Another Redeemer, at aomin.org.
That's the problem.
This portion of The Dividing Line has been made possible by the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. The Apostle Paul spoke of the importance of solemnly testifying of the gospel of the grace of God. The proclamation of God's truth is the most important element of His worship in His church. The elders and people of the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church invite you to worship with them this coming Lord's Day. The morning Bible study begins at 9:30 a.m., and the worship service is at 10:45.
That's the problem with Calvinism.
Evening services are at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday, and the Wednesday night prayer meeting is at 7. The Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church is located at 3805 North 12th Street in Phoenix. You can call for further information at 602-26-GRACE. If you're unable to attend, you can still participate with your computer and real audio at prbc.org, where the ministry extends around the world through the archives of sermons and Bible study lessons available 24 hours a day.
Read my book.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. Following Jesus, it's a walk of praise.
Read my book.
Welcome back. Hey, having a little fun. Hey, you know, if you can't have a little fun, why in the world are you listening to this thing anyways? What can I say? I don't see that we have any phone. Now, no one has called in. They just want to keep hearing this type of stuff. But I only had so much of it. I mean, we can go back and we can look at some of the things Dave Hunt had to say. But I've already put that on the blog. So what can I say?
Read my book.
Yeah, I know. And the problem with Calvinism, so George, exactly how does God know the future? Well, the problem with Calvinism is, if we just simply took that particular line away from Mr. Bryson, would he ever be able to start a response? That's the question. I don't know that he could. I didn't make that was all the cuts I made. That was it. Obviously, you know, I can hear cackling in the other room. I will mention this, as those of you who are just waiting to call in at 877-753-3341 do, because I know that that you want to. On page 31, I had to at least admit this is interesting. Let me back up here a little bit. While the caste system of Reformed theology transcends the earthly distinctions of humanity, i.e. rich, poor, black, white, Jew, Gentile, highly cultured, lowly peasants, etc., it is an undeniable feature of Calvinism. In fact, the eternal castes of the elect and reprobate necessarily include representatives of all temporal distinctions. I'm not sure what a temporal distinction is.
That's the problem with Calvinism.
Oh, okay. James White, while focusing on the election side of the election reprobation coin, says that, and then he quotes me, quote, "God elects a specific people unto himself without reference to anything they do."
that serves you right.
I don't know how that happened. Honestly, I really, really, how'd that happen? I didn't do that. somebody must have come online and I didn't even realize that, yep, Thinker came online. Thinker's back. We lost Thinker for a while, but anyways, God elects a specific people in himself without reference to anything they do. This means the basis of God's choice of the elect is solely within himself, his grace, mercy, his will. It is not man's actions, works, or even foreseen faith that draws God's choice. God's election is unconditional and final. Now, what's interesting is that this same section from the Potter's Freedom, Ephesians 1, Dave Hunt quotes, but he uses ellipses to remove the fact that I'm talking about election here, not reprobation, and he sort of does the let's take one quote from one page and one quote from another page and one quote from 50 pages down the road, stick them all together. And voila, you have your resultant quote, and ends up, you know, misrepresenting things there. Now, at least he recognizes that he is saying, while focusing on the election side of the election reprobation coin, says, quote, and then he says, after quoting me, he says this is the bottom of page 31 of The Dark Side of Calvinism. While White may or may not appreciate what I am going to say, maybe this is why he didn't give it to me. While White may or may not appreciate what I'm going to say, logically, White's view, at the very least, implies that God reprobates a specific people away from himself without reference to anything they do. In fact, although this is hushed up or even denied in at least some hypo-Calvinist circles, Calvinism maintains an unconditional election to damnation as much as it does an unconditional election to salvation. All Calvinists shout about their doctrine of unconditional election. Most, however, whisper when talking about unconditional reprobation, if they speak of it at all. They boast of the former while they're seemingly embarrassed about the latter. Well, of course, look up and Thinker's attempting to DCC chat with me. Someone say hi to Thinker for me, and tell her that we're a little bit busy today. anyway, and she keeps trying. I'm going to have to put her on ignore here unless someone can explain to her that I'm not interested in chatting at the moment. We're a little bit busy. But unconditional reprobation, is that really what we believe? This really goes to the heart of one of the most one of the deepest misunderstandings of enemies of the Reformed faith and what they really hold to. They really do think that sin is irrelevant here because of the fact that we emphasize that election has nothing to do with our performance or anything found within us. They think that there is this equal ultimacy. This even came out in the Bible Answer Man program. And therefore, they want to create this direct connection between the two so that the damnation of individuals is seen as not related to anything in themselves. We can talk about sin and things like that, but you even heard it in what Hank Hanegraaff was saying to me. Well, they were made that way. They were made that way. There's nothing they can do about that, so on and so forth, right? The problem, of course, is that the whole issue of grace and mercy, the foundation of election, is something that, and this came out in my response to Geisler's book, too. Remember the story about the kids swimming in the lake. Some of you who haven't read The Potter's Freedom or Chosen But Free, you may not be familiar with this. But Geisler's example of this, in essence, was the kids swimming in the pond that the farmer has put up a sign that says, "Do not swim here." And he says basically what Christians are saying, or what Calvinists are saying, is that the farmer comes along and these three boys are in his pond. Now they're not supposed to be there. They're sinning, but they start to drown. And the Calvinist God only reaches in and rescues one of the three. That's his idea. Now, of course, he's trivialized sin and so on and so forth. And remember when I responded to that, I said, no, the proper example would be that you have a sovereign king, and you have rebels who have broken into the king's castle, and they are raping and pillaging and burning, and they're attacking the king's family, and they're destroying the king's property, and the king comes back to his castle, and he sees what these people are doing, and he sends people to tell them, look, the castle's burning down, you must come out, but they don't want to. They don't want to come out. Putting thinker on ignore now. They don't want to come out. They love what they're doing. They love the fact that the castle's going to burn down around them and kill them in the process. And so what the king does is he sends his son in, and his son powerfully saves some of these rebels who are spitting in the king's face and destroying the king's castle. The illustrations that people try to use completely miss that particular element of what God does. The not only undeservedness of grace, but the power of grace and the love of rebellion on the part of those who receive this grace, and this grace must by nature change them. That's why it can't be based on anything in themselves, because if it is, then these rebel sinners would first have to change themselves. And so they miss that element of it. And they miss the fact that election is based upon grace, damnation is based upon justice, and they don't see the difference between those two things, and to make them equally ultimate with one another is unbiblical. The Bible doesn't say that. Well, logically, it must be. No, our system is exegetical. It is based upon the text of Scripture. And as we see in these kinds of arguments, there was, oh, man, look through this book. There is absolutely almost no, there isn't any exegesis in this book. There is one attempt, and it is interesting. There's one attempt, at least, and this is strange, because Bryson demonstrates, he looked at what I said about Matthew 23:37, so he does try to attempt to respond to that, but there's numerous other places where if he was going to say what he was saying, he'd have to respond to the objections raised by my own book, which he's shown familiarity with, but he doesn't even attempt to do so. So, interesting stuff. You can see on the blog where I've posted some of the things on John 6. There's more stuff that's in there that that we need to respond to eventually or over time, and maybe as people get the book, or if they can't get the book, I mean, it's not like there's a lot of them being published at the moment, people call in and talk about this thing. So let's go ahead and start taking our our phone calls, and let's go ahead and start with Eric, if we can go that direction, Mr. AOM in person. Eric, both of our callers that we have right now are in California. That means these are going to be strange questions. But let's let's go ahead and talk with Eric in Orange, California. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Dr. White.
How you doing?
Good. I'm involved with a guys group, and they we're thinking of going through a book. It's called Meditative Prayer by a guy named Richard Peace. He's a teaches the classes at Fuller, and he. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of Richard Foster.
Yes, Richard Foster. The other person I don't know about, Richard Foster, I've heard about.
Yeah, and then it's the book seems okay. Just some of the styles of prayer they had in there just seems sort of questionable. I wonder if
read my book.
What book?
That was just George. He wants you to read his book. I'm not familiar with the book. I'm sorry. I've not seen it. I couldn't comment upon it. Obviously, I went to Fuller, and that was a long time ago. And even then, I would have been described as the token fundamentalist. So,
yeah.
You know, it's really hard to say.
Have you heard anything regarding like meditative prayer or anything called a Lectio Divina?
No.
No. Okay. It seemed like really subjective, like sort of taking verses out of context and meditating on them.
Oh.
Regardless of the context,
that's probably not a good thing to do. But I'm unfortunately not in a position to be able to be of assistance to you at that point. As far as the book goes, I'm afraid I just simply would have to say in a blanket way that you would have to look very, very carefully and closely at anything coming out of Fuller Seminary these days.
Yeah,
that's just all there is to it.
Do you have any books on prayer that you would recommend, or?
Well, it depends on what kind of group you're talking about.
Okay.
There's a tremendous amount of stuff on prayer from the Puritans that is really, really good, but because of the way it's written, a lot of folks today would have a hard time with it. Reading just Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Hypocrites Deficient in the Duty of Prayer, is enough to bring so much conviction to you that you may never do a study again. So,
okay.
There's just stuff like that out there.
Yeah.
And so the Puritans would have a tremendous amount of great stuff. There are Puritan prayers in the book, The Valley of Vision, that give you samples. There's lots of things you could look at that might be older, but probably better as a result.
Okay.
Well,
thanks a lot for taking my call.
All righty. God bless. 877-753-3341. Possibly Eric had not heard the program, but Aaron in California, I'm sure, has. And so, Aaron, I only have one suggestion for you.
Read my book.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Have you read my book?
Which one?
The Potter's Freedom.
No.
Read my book.
I don't think you've mentioned the trophy comment from Hank.
That's the problem with Calvinism.
Are you still doing that to me? Have you forgotten about the trophy comment from Hank?
Trophy comment?
Yeah, the trophy comment that takes the cake for being the most blatant lead-in and absolute hostile way to detract from your position.
You mean at the very beginning.
After you gave the review of John 6 was, now, Bryson, isn't that the point? You believe it deals with faith and not determinism?
Well, there are a couple of them. I mean, there are a number of statements that were directly in response to that, and obviously the one that made me chuckle, and in fact, as I was listening, because the recording I was listening to came off satellite, so it's as clean as a whistle. I mean, it's really, really, really high quality, and at one point, I was about to lead into the Lazarus comment, and I wanted to be fair. I wanted to be, I was just trying to be, to say, now, you know, Hank, I know you take a different perspective here. And I said, I know you feel differently about this. And you may recall the response was, it's not a matter of feelings, it's a matter of facts.
Yeah, that was just really mean. I pointed that one out too, but.
And I was just sort of like, excuse me, I removed the spear from my back here. I was just trying to be nice here. Come on, you know?
He's declined debating you, hasn't he?
There's been no challenge. That's not really something that Hank does. I mean, I personally feel that it would have been a lot clearer if it had just been Hank and I.
That is completely inappropriate for a moderator to say something like that.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have minded at all if it had been put in this in the perspective of, and you know what? Obviously, I have adopted the position of libertarian free will. I've gone to print in defense of it. And so George and I, you know, we're going to be basically saying the same thing, and we're going to have a good conversation here. I'm sure that James will be able to hold his own, so let's go ahead and debate the issue. That would have been fine with me. That I wouldn't have had any problem with that. There could have been three people in there. It would not have bothered me as long as I was given an equal amount of time to do so, and we would have identified who was who as far as the debate was concerned. So that wouldn't have bothered me, but when you're one of the debaters and you get to control what questions are being asked and answered, that's when it gets a little bit difficult to deal with. But
I just thought that's about faith, not determinism. That's like, well, engines are about cars, not mechanics. That was just so, I don't know how you would recover any kind of position from something that's destructive. But
you gotta admit, every time that happened, though, I mean, I even played the one, well, you certainly believe God changes the heart, and then what was George's response? Yeah, he does, but it doesn't mean you're regenerated. In fact, God can change your heart, and you can still be a God hater. And it's like, you know what, Hank, that's not exactly what you thought he was going to say, is it? You know? Okay. And so it didn't end up really working out that way anyways, especially when, right at the beginning, wouldn't you agree, George, with R.C. Sproul, that what James just said is hyper-Calvinism? and I appreciated at least the fact that George said, no, actually what James White's representing is what R.C. Sproul says and what John MacArthur says and what John Piper says and mainline Calvinistic teaching, which he calls hypo-Calvinist because he says we're somewhat afraid of what Calvin himself said. But anyways, it didn't
let me move on to that really quickly. That's what I wanted to talk about. The Frankenstein example. He at one point said, if I create a Frankenstein monster, I'm responsible for what that Frankenstein monster does.
Right.
Now, a little mechanical sequencing we do here. I was thinking, now wait a minute. Even when God gave you free will, he knew what you would choose, but you freely chose it. So, now technically, if Frankenstein made the Frankenstein monster, took this thing called free will, and knew what free will was going to do, if he put it in the monster, it would go around and kill people. Now, the Frankenstein doctor could go put it in the Frankenstein monster, it would go around and kill everyone, but because it's this magical thing called free will, even though he knew what he was going to do, and he's the one who initiated it, placed it in there, knew, put it in the monster, gave him the capability, he's not responsible for it. That's just like, you know, if you take these magic free will bullets, you can shoot people with them and not be responsible for it. It just boils down to that. I don't know. Maybe that example's been covered before, but I would say if they try and use that Frankenstein monster, that's what I'm going to bring up if someone tries to do that.
But so. You see, what you've missed is if you would just understand that Frankenstein, the monster, was the one who caused the divorce of Sonny and Cher.
Read my book.
Well, and that's the whole point, isn't it? I mean, when people keep saying, well, no, you know, God knew that they were going to do this, and God created, but there was no decree. So God knows this is going to happen, so the future is fixed outside of God's sovereign decree. And they just don't, I just don't know if they just haven't thought about it, they haven't been challenged on it, but they don't want to realize that if you're going to say that, then you have to answer the question, well, then what did form the very fabric of time? If it's not God, it was something else, it's outside of God, and it's not under his control. So what does that mean in regards to, you know, all the rest of this
stuff?
Remember
the verbatim quote, yes, God did create people to send them to hell, but no, he didn't create people to send them to hell.
Yes.
I guess God's just a bad designer, and we're going to be punished for that.
You just don't understand, and you know what?
That's the problem with capitalism.
There it is. There you go. Hey, thanks for calling. Bye.
Thank you, doctor.
See you later. Bye. Hey, I only got a couple seconds here, and I'm looking at this topic. It's like, oh, yeah, going to do this one in 90 seconds. But, hey, we might as well try it. Let's talk with Chris in Pittsburgh. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
It's going to be a real quick one.
Yeah, okay. This shouldn't take long. basically, I'm asking you to confirm or deny something somebody else told me, and that was whether or that supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism have absolutely nothing to do with the point in time at which the decrees occurred. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I could answer that in one of two ways. I could simply go...
Read my book.
Or I could say, actually, obviously, the entire supra-lapsarian, infra-lapsarian argument is in regards to logical order, not temporal priority. Logical order, not something taking place in time. Both sides would agree. We're, in essence, here trying to categorize or follow or determine... the logical order of concepts in God's sovereign decree, which I think is we could rightly say we really cannot do dogmatically.
I'm just not sure that's clear in Scripture.
Well, yeah, the point is that the idea of temporality, of placing a point in time in history, that's not a part of the historic discussion. Maybe somebody on a website someplace thinks it is, but... the historic discussion, recognizing that this is an eternal decree and it's outside the realm of time, is not trying to say that there is a temporal order. It's a logical order. Now, the problem is that when we think of a logical order, since we are time-bound beings, we automatically associate the time element with it. But at least as theologians were discussing it, in the heyday of theology, in essence, they separated that out, and we're not trying to say that first he decided this, and then he decided this, and then there was a couple days in between and decided this. That's actually not a part of the historic discussion at all. It's not. Okay?
Okay, well, thanks for clarifying that.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks for listening today. And thanks for calling 877-753-3341. Write that one down, because on Thursday morning, at 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time, Lord willing, we will be back to take your phone calls and to discuss these things. You know, some people might say, "Well, you know, I just, I just don't think you handled that subject in a meaningfully serious way." Well, you know what? When I try over and over and over and over again to get someone to deal with a biblical passage. And anyone who listened to the BAM debate knows I kept bringing them up, and I kept bringing them up. Sound like a broken record, because we will not deal with the text of Scripture. And they say to me, read the book, and I finally get hold of it, and what happens? There's nothing there. Well, you can either just get all mad about it, or you can address it like we addressed it today. We made our point. Hopefully everybody got it. And we're going to continue that discussion and all the other things going on out there in the world of apologetics on Thursday morning, Lord willing, 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. Thanks for listening. Make sure to pray for Shannon Porter tonight. God bless. See you on Thursday.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries.
If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-0318 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. for The Dividing Line.